This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here at Oracle Open World with Jenny Griffiths, who's the founder and CEO of Snaptech.
Nice to meet you. I founded the company around 8 years ago officially, unofficially around 10 years ago. My background is I'm a computer scientist. Got really into the field of computer vision, this idea of how can you teach computers to see in the way that humans do. So that's why I founded the company, and it was all around how can you get someone from looking at an image, so something they've taken on their mobile phone, an image in a magazine, even a product, and take them to relevant things to buy online. The company itself has been running 8 years, and we license to publishers and to retailers.
You're a visual search engine. How does that actually work for the person who's using it?
I always think the customer doesn't care how it works. It's all around what it does for them. Despite being the software engineer, I try not to be too proud about my tech. But basically, what you've got going in the background, I'll start with the core engine. It's kind of a blend of mathematical heuristic, super old school, what makes a dress, what makes a pair of shoes, and then led on top of that is the nice new school DNNs, CNNs, and this deep learning that's taken the world by storm over this last 2 years. And from a consumer point of view, what that looks like is someone can take a photo on their mobile phone, we instantly recognise what's in that image, and then we can link people to similar items. And then when you're looking at web experiences, you don't want to consciously be caring about out of visual search as a consumer. If you click on a link and it's sold out, how can you seamlessly just direct people to look at things they want to look at?
You say instantly recognise. We've all tried to take a photo and say, find me something similar, and it's come up with weird things like bananas with hats and pandas and goodness knows what. How do you actually make it accurate?
Yes, definitely. Accuracy in visual search is the number one nemesis, I'd say, of the industry. There's some really great companies out there, and then some really terrible people wear like bananas in hats are basically all you get back. A lot of what we do is being realistic about the consumer experience and what you can expect to achieve. So for instance, if you take a photo on your mobile, we say we're going to show you things that are similar colour and texture. We're not going to look at the shape because we don't know how that woman's going to be standing. We don't know if you've got the occlusion problem, which is, I get really nerdy, it's like if someone's hair's in front of their shoulder. To a human, we obviously fill in the gap. To a computer, you're missing a bunch of pixels. That's how we make sure that accuracy levels are high. We basically tailor the extremes of where we want the algorithms to go. So in a high-risk environment where you can't control the lighting, you can't control the angle, we go, right, colour and texture basically never fails. When you get to really beautifully shot products, which are on a white background, and you've got all that detailed product information, we can go to town and go, right, we can give you shape, we can give you labelling, we can give you texture, we can tell you what kind of material it is. And that's the key to making a really reliable user experience, one that doesn't disappoint.
How do you deal with the types of images people throw in? It might be off a mobile phone because they're stood watching somebody walk up a red carpet. It might be they're sitting on a plane and somebody stands up near them and they're, ooh, I like that. Or, who is that? Or, as you say, it might be something they photograph from a magazine and they want to find this out. There's such different inputs with massively different levels of noise. If I'm looking for stuff, I don't want to know about the noise. I just simply want you to recognise it. So if there's a group of people, could I just kind of draw around something and say, identify that bit?
It all comes down to what you're describing as a background segmentation problem, and it's whether it's assisted or unassisted. For all the listeners, unassisted segmentation is basically the holy grail of visual search. If you can take a photo of anything, you don't need any user interaction, it just goes bing, this is what's in the image. Then you've got assisted background segmentation, which is all around, do you need to draw a box, do you need to draw the dots, if you need some form of user interaction to steer it. If we're going unassisted, we can do it, but we try and put hints in the user experience. We design templates that go over a camera to say, hey, make sure you line up the image so it's within this zone, and we're making sure that people are being a bit more conscious about the quality of images that they're taking. And then if you go assisted, which is what we do for editors in magazines, if you've got Meghan Markle standing next to Prince Harry, we go, draw a box around Meghan Markle, please. That would be great. So we don't actually find his suit instead of her dress. There's little hints and tips all around the place. I always think it's better to ask someone to spend a second doing an action than give them random results.
So if I think about from a retail perspective, somebody's taken a photo of something they've seen. Is this then for me to say, oh, you've taken that photo, I have something similar?
Yes, exactly. If you look at it from a retail perspective, there's this huge problem in retail now, which is you can shop online 24/7. It means the way that retailers have dealt with this is they've increased the number of products that they're selling, which is great. You've got 250,000 little black dresses. How do you find the one you're looking for? Because you know it's in there. The first thing we do is we make sure that we work with brands that have this big product discoverability issue so that there's a use case for visual search rather than just being PR noise, which is another problem in the industry. And then from that point, you're basically able to go, we're going to filter it down based on colour and texture, we're going to filter down based on shape. We're actually the only people in the world who let people focus in on attributes that they want to hone in on. There's a trend in visual search for being quite generic about attributes and throwing it into a convolutional neural net and see what comes out. It's a bit of a big black box. In something like fashion, people like to hone in on what it was that attracted them towards an item. So if you try on a suit, was it the colour, was it the texture of the fabric, or was it actually the cut? And by offering people different attributes to home in on, it basically means they find what they're looking for more relevantly.
My daughter every now and again watches some wedding dress show on television, and you hear people on that saying, oh, well, I want something with a princess thing, or I want something that's fluffy, or I want something that's sparkly. Somebody takes a photo, let's say, of a wedding dress, but they want those other bits in. How can they send that to the retailer and say, I like this dress, but actually I want this bit sparkly, or I want this bit not quite so puffed out?
We've looked at that in the past. Can you give people the tools to be able to create their own dresses? We haven't got there quite yet, but what we are doing is basically when someone interacts with the system, they do on average around 9 searches, which is interesting because they start with an image and then they go, oh, that one's interesting. Just show me something like that. And then it throws up another 20 dresses which are cobalt blue with a V-neck or whatever. And they go, actually, I really like that V-neck of the green one. And then they'll click on that. Fashion's a lot about serendipity. So it's interesting when you bring visual search into it, it introduces a bit of serendipity into results. So people end up going down. What you just described was really interesting, which is when you said it's princess and it's fluffy and it's got sparkles. And where visual search is really interesting in fashion is there's no common language and no common lexicon for how people speak about stuff. To me, it might be blue. To you, it might be cobalt. To him, it might be red because he's colorblind. You never know. This is where I think visual search has the power to be super disruptive in these industries where there's not actually a way of talking about it. And it means the metadata in the background is horrible and messy and nasty and no one likes to touch it. So it's quite nice if you've got a solution where you go, don't show me the data, it's crap. Just show me the image and then you know it's going to be good.
But how do you deal with size in fashion? Something that looks good on a size 0 may not look so good on somebody who's size 15 or size 18 or something like that. Cut changes depending upon size and body shape. If somebody's taking a photo of something and says, do you have that in my size? How do you adjust that to perhaps understand what that size really means?
So we've stayed away from the sizing image problem quite a lot. Mainly, a lot of companies doing the avatar style thing. The richness of the data on the retail side isn't there yet. There's a bit of an uncanny valley thing going on at the moment, so I'm looking forward to that problem being solved.
It's interesting because the avatar thing is something I think I first saw presented on stage, must be a decade or more ago.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and it's fit and cut in fashion is the number one problem, and it's why average return rate for retailers is 70%, it's through the roof. The way that we're dealing with it is coming back to that being able to hone in on the attributes you like. Most women know, like I know, never to wear a wrap dress because it will make me look like Shrek. I love the way no one can see me because this podcast is great, but I know that A-line skirt will look really good on me, and I think women over the years, they just get to know what fits them and what doesn't. So if you're able to take the attributes of, like, I love that cobalt dress that so-and-so was wearing, that cut would look terrible on me, show me everything in that color, right, that's the cut that will look good on me, drop down into that. I think it's letting women trust their instincts and men actually on what will look good on them, and then going through the horrible trial and error of hitting buy and seeing what turns up on your door.
I think this is married 25 years and I have to admit I don't know what an A-line skirt is, and I will get some stick for this, I suspect. But we do have a problem, and you alluded to it there, returns rates, failure rates of shopping. Now we know there's a portion of that market that just orders it because they've got a party, who wears it, sends it back. And it's a big problem for retailers. In that genuine returns group, do you have any numbers from any of the retailers you've worked with who said it's cut our returns rate or it's improved our sell-through rate?
They don't really have that data. A few, I know, data black holes everywhere in retail. I'm not going to touch that one yet. I think there's probably another super smart startup out there who's doing it. But where we've been working with retailers is on the in-store bit. Sounds really weird, but when someone goes to a fitting room, it's basically like a data black hole for retailers because you go in there, you're at your highest propensity to buy, you bother queuing, you bother getting change, trying on a shirt, whatever. And then at that point where you don't buy it, 70% of people don't buy in a fitting room, exactly the same return rate actually as online. But you don't know what to do. I'm not sure if it's a British thing, but I just have a really awkward conversation with someone and I run away as fast as I possibly can. But you don't get any insight from that. And even if someone's super chatty and extrovert and go, oh my God, I'm really short and the trousers didn't fit me properly, that's not captured anywhere. So what we're doing with visual search physical environments is being able to say, okay, you've tried on this dress, what was wrong. Was it the colour? Was it the cut? Was it the size? Was it the quality? Depending on what people say, we tap into different bits of the algorithm. So you can say, I tried on this dress, fits me really nicely, but the colour washed me out. Great, here's everything similar, loads of different colorways, same cut. Do you want to buy it online? Do you want to click and collect? And we're finding that the richness of data that that gives to retailers in store is becoming interesting. Now we're looking at, with Oracle actually in Marketing Cloud, being able to say, if you do a return, once again, what was wrong? Was it the size? Was it the quality? And at that point, you can flip a return as another opportunity for a retailer to sell back to you, because you do want to buy something. So if you're trying a pair of jeans and they were too tight, you can just say, they were too tight, and then they get that data, and then the user gets something in return. So I'm a big fan of data. If you're a user and you're giving up your data, you've got to get something back. And that's just my mission in life.
If only more people who gather data had that idea. What a shock. We talked here a lot about fashion. What other markets are you using this in?
We do fashion and firearms, and I bet you weren't expecting that answer.
I'm going to a party tonight. What cut of suit would work well with my Ruger underneath my arm?
Exactly. It's a common problem. No, I'm not an arms dealer. Basically, as you probably gathered from this, our thing is shape recognition. That's what makes us really different to our competitors. And weirdly, I used to work in defence before I started the company. And we saw there was a call for tender out for a bit of software where you could look into x-ray images in airports. Basically, if a bag scans, go, where's the threat? Where's the risk? We use the same shape technology to find risks within contraband within x-ray images. So if something goes through a fast parcel, so an airport's a great example. Is there a threat? Yes or no? It's like saying, is there a pair of shoes? It's really fun. What kind of threat is it? Is it the pin from a hand grenade, or is it a full-on AK-47 in someone's bag? Hopefully not. And then it finally localizes the threat. So we go, okay, if you're a bagging scanner person, it's really not what they're called. We basically draw a little red circle around it and go, this is where you want to be focusing. The reason that we did it was basically to see, I always say, we're not a fashion tech company, we're an AI company. And then I realized I was lying massively because we'd only ever done fashion. We moved into there just to go, actually, does the tech extend here? And then hit on a really interesting market.
So where do you extend that to from there? Because if we look at the television and we look at what's going on around us, it's not just about fashion or guns or people buying cars. There are a lot of good causes out there that struggle to actually identify things. There's this advert running for a competitor about snow leopards at this moment in time on television and AI. But it's a very serious issue, and it's something that as we get more satellite imagery available to us, people are interested in.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating space at the moment. Where we are focusing as a company, because it's tempting to go, we're going to make the whole world searchable, and then it's, hang on a minute, we're going up against big guys for that one. Where we're focusing is where you don't have the richness of metadata, either in the background or in your environment. So for instance, if you're looking at things like buildings, you've got GPS and you've got whatnot going on in the background. If you look at things like wine bottles, DVD covers, you can read the text and get the information from there. So where we've decided to focus is soft object search, the things that change in form, things where you don't have metadata, so guns, dresses, obviously group them together. Things like furniture, homeware, cosmetics. On the doing good side, we're beginning to look at ethical fashion now around this whole huge environmental crisis around fast fashion. Being able to say, actually, as a conscientious consumer, I love that dress, but it's from a brand that treats their employees really badly or has horrible fibres that are going to damage the planet. How can I find a more sustainable version? So that's what we're working on at the moment.
But all of this takes data. All of this requires massive processing power at the back end. You've gone with Oracle's cloud infrastructure. How is that working for you? But more importantly, how does that play out to the customers who then want to take this on?
I always think visual search, any search in general, actually, it's all about speed because people don't want to see it buffering. And yeah, it's just a nightmare. I'm horribly impatient when it comes to text. I'm quite a good person to test it. Everything we do is around the speed of processing, both on input. So we process around 3 million items a day on the fashion side. How can you make sure you process them all in a day is a big one for us. And then when a consumer searches, you want it to be sub half a second to get them a load of results. OCI has just been really good for us, basically on speed of processing. Some of our operations we do around 250 a second on OCI, on CPUs, and we also use GPU shapes. And also on the R&D side, we use basically a load of GPU compute power to prototype, do loads of R&D, and then I'm the horribly stingy person at the end going, right, we made it work. Can it work on a CPU now? Because that's way cheaper. That's the way that we use the infrastructure.
What about scale? Because these days, if you suddenly get a large retailer come in, that will attract a lot of competitors because they don't want to be left behind in this market. But as a tech company, producing a solution for one company and then suddenly having to do it for 10, 15, 20, 50, 100, it's a level of scale that breaks a lot of organizations. What has enabled you to scale?
There's two sides of scale in AI as I see it. One is the actual infrastructure and one is around the data and the training, which I can talk for hours about, so I'll try and limit myself. On the infrastructure side, we use managed Kubernetes, which has been really, really powerful for us, because if one retailer goes absolutely mental, we can go, whoa, okay, we know that we're going to handle that. We try and separate people out so that if someone does have an insane day, then that's all fine. And then on the other side of scale and the speed of rollout is there's a lot of bespoke training that's going on in AI at the moment. A lot of people pitch going, great, we can make your brand searchable, give us 30,000 images, we'll train on neural nets on your data. I'm a big believer that you shouldn't be training neural nets per retailer, because you have this horrible thing in AI called overfitting, which is not talked about enough. But to use a really ridiculous example, if you train just on one person's set of images, let's say you've got a lingerie model is probably different to a normal fashion model. How do you know that you're identifying the lingerie, or if you're just identifying that woman's face? So then if she leaves, goes on maternity leave or something, comes back, there's a new model, your AI system could just fall through the floor because you don't know what attributes you're training on.
But this is a common AI problem. We had the white hands, black hands problem a little while ago. A photographer was looking for some black baby hands and she used the AI to search the internet and all it came back with was white baby hands. And we see this across so many types of AI out there. How do we get that diversity of data?
Diverse data sets, I'd say they're probably the biggest threat to good AI solutions at the moment. What we do is we train across all of the different retail partners that we work with. So we pull in data from around 16,000 retail brands, which is a nightmare for our engineers. But it means that if you do onboard a new customer, you know that their style of photography will be covered and you will have a diverse range of models, diverse range of sizes. So I think that's the way that people should be looking at engineering their solutions, is not how can you make it work incredibly accurately with just one person. It's how can you ensure diversity across a range of whatever you're searching for, whether it's hands or whether it's retail, so that you're future-proofing the AI that you're building.
Do your retailers get that? Because it seems to me that one of the ways to get that diversity is say, okay, I've got 50 retailers. Actually, I'm going to just do my training across all of you irrespective. So you just contribute your images, but I'm going to aggregate.
With data rights, obviously, but that's a big thing for us. But yeah, anyone who opts into us, they know that we're using their data for training, but equally that they're getting a nice, diverse, trained AI model. Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's very hard to pitch because sometimes you go to retail and say, what do you need? A data feed. Your competitors just walked in here and said they needed 100,000 images. And then you have to have a whole argument with them around how that's a really bad thing. Because in fashion, the more work you have to do and the more custom it is for you, the more luxurious it is. So this is an interesting point in AI, is it feels good when someone does work for you. But actually, it's not necessarily a good thing. It's quite an interesting one. I think quite a few people are coming across this now in AI.
Thank you for talking to us today.
No worries. Thanks for having me.